Our second speaker is Dr. Severin de Nulin, who is a lecturer in international development at the University of Bath. Her research specialism is in development theory and ethics, and is currently working on the role of religion and values in development. She's recently published Religion in Development, Rewriting the Secular Script. She's the Education Officer of the Human Development and Capability Association. She's also a visiting lecturer at the University of Bethlehem in Palestine, and has a DPhil in Development Studies from the University of Oxford, as well as an MA in Economics. So we're looking forward very much to your contribution. Also, that you've just returned from Ecuador and have some stories from Ecuador that you can bring to us.
Thank you very much. Well, as we launch today this new partnership between DFID and faith communities, I would like to make some reflections on one principle that was called for by the document, that of mutual understanding. And my focus tonight will be on how faith communities bring their belief that God created the world into the public sphere, and how they bring their belief that we cannot separate the material from the spiritual, and the implication for that belief in for poverty, reduction, and justice. And 3 weeks ago, indeed, I was in Ecuador, and I was at the conference on sustainable development alternatives. And the conference opened with a prayer by a Quechua, an indigenous man, around an altar of harvested goods. And I had a PowerPoint with a picture of the altar. But imagine yourself all the fruit and vegetables available in Latin America, all well arranged into an altar. And this Quechua man began by praising God for giving this abundant food and sustaining our human life. And after some singing, he gave a short introduction to the Quechua indigenous cosmovision. And he emphasized two elements. The first, he said, is when two Quechua people salute themselves, they say, "You are me and I am you," to emphasize that our own individuality is found in our relationships to others. And the second element, he said, that was central to the Quechua cosmovision of life was the Pachamama, the Mother Earth, that humans are part of the natural environment and we take our lives from it. And then he finished by some petition prayers that we may all live in harmony with each other and the natural environment, which is, in summary, the Quechua understanding of living well. To live well for the indigenous community is to live in harmony with each other and with the environment, what they call the Sumat Kozai. And I do have to say that I felt like being at Mass, more or less, hearing a sermon on the Trinity, but finishing just at the offertory with this beautiful altar of fruit and vegetables. And in Ecuador, the indigenous communities have been very vocal in trying to advance their own cosmovision into the public sphere. And in 2009, the government introduced a new constitution to include precisely this indigenous cosmovision, how to translate into policy this harmony with each other and with nature. And the government established a 25-year plan called the National Plan for Buen Vivir, the National Plan for Living Well. And the plan includes objectives regarding health, education, as one would expect, but as well it includes very strong objectives to change the structure of the economy. The solidarity economy is a very strong word in this Quechua cosmovision. And so they have objectives to make taxation more progressive, to support the peasant agriculture, to reduce the power of agribusinesses, and as well, they have included the right of nature. It's the first constitution in the world to include the rights of nature, that nature has a right to exist. And they've decided to leave some oil on the ground in the Amazon, called in the Yasuni National Park, to emphasize their commitment to the environment. However, behind this rhetoric of living well, there is quite a few contradictions, but I will not go into the nitty-gritty of Ecuadorian politics or Latin American politics. What I would like to highlight from this Quechua altar of Thanksgiving for a purpose tonight is this. The first implication of this altar is that the inclusion of the indigenous cosmovision in national politics has a long history of social struggles. It is because they have suffered exploitation and dispossession of the land that indigenous, over the years, started to articulate their own vision of what it is to live well, and then to bring that vision of living well into the public sphere. And they are starting to demand a new economic order based on respect for humans and nature, and no longer an economic order based on exploitation of nature and exploitation of humans. And the second implication is that it is because there were some political opportunities that the vision of living well started to be translated into politics. It's not by accident that suddenly in 2009, Ecuador had this constitution on the good life. It was because the conditions were there for them to bring their cosmovision into the public sphere. And of special importance is the organizational capacity of indigenous groups. Because all the indigenous communities were able to organize themselves under one common voice, they were able then to bring that cosmovision into policy. And I see this launch of this new partnership between DFID and faith communities tonight in a very similar light. First, over the years, faith communities have articulated their own vision of living well in response to the experience of exploitation and poverty of many of their members. And I speak here for the Catholic faith community, which is the one I come from. Its social tradition started with the encyclical Rerum Novarum in the 19th century by Pope Leon XIII. And I think it is fair to say that Rerum Novarum changed the face of Europe and contributed to the welfare state. And the Pope responded to the voices of some European priests who were dealing with ministering the exploited workers. And I say this because one must see the Catholic social tradition as emerging first from the experience of poverty and injustice, and then gets articulated theologically. And the second implication for tonight is that there are today, in 2012, political opportunities, for reasons it would be too long to dwell on, to bring this distinctive religious cosmovision into the public sphere. And 20 years ago, I don't think that DFID would have launched this new partnership with faith communities. And what I would like to do now is to focus on two areas of potential exchange and dialogue and construction of mutual understanding between faith communities and the UK government. And I'll focus on economic growth and markets. Well, DFID believes that economic growth is the most effective way of raising the incomes of the poor. But we also know that economic growth has environmental limits. So now DFID supports green growth, low carbon growth. And the UK government is also trying to move towards what is called green national accounting. So how to account for the environment into measures of national production? And so with the idea of green accounting, the idea is to put a price on the environment and account for the use and depletion of natural resources into the GDP. So if a country cuts down in trees and exports them, for the moment, this increases GDP because more goods are produced, more furniture is produced, so it increases GDP. But on the green national accounting, this depletion of the forest will be accounted for into the GDP measure. But tonight is not the place to go into the technical discussion of green national accounting. What I would like to say is that faith communities would go beyond that. And here, speaking from the Catholic social tradition, we wouldn't simply go for the greening economic growth. The faith community questions, well, the Catholic social tradition especially, questions the very desirability of economic growth altogether and asks, well, is economic growth desirable? And it asserts that it is desirable only if it enables people to live in dignity. And in the text, I think, that is available on the table, I have a full quote of the encyclical by Pope Paul VI that says that that economic growth is only desirable if it enables people to live in dignity. And there is a point where growth actually limits the growth of the human person. There is a point when economic growth destroys human growth. So the focus is not so much on economic growth, whether we call it green, poor, inclusive, or whatever adjective we want to put before growth. Economic growth, whatever it is, needs to be accompanied by an equal focus on human growth. But what does human growth mean? Well, for the Catholic social tradition, human growth means growing in communion with God. And I'm sure that there'll be many similarities with other faith traditions as well, that growing as a human being means growing in communion with God. So how to translate that belief into policy? It seems rather difficult to translate that belief in God into policy. However, some people are showing that it is possible. And I refer back to Latin America. And there were two videos that I showed to students in Bath. And one shows a farmer in Peru who has been asked by the government to take a new job because the government wants the land for mining. And so the government is trying to persuade him to give up his job and said, well, you know, you will learn computing skills and you will earn a lot of money. Why don't you get this job? Why don't you leave your land and get the job that we are offering you? And this farmer, who had just a primary level education, replied, but where do you think that your yuca is coming from? By pressing a button on the keyboard? I don't want your job. Go away with your mining project. And another person from another farmer from Panama, who was offered lots of money to sell his land because the government wanted to use the land to build a hydroelectric power plant. He said, you can give me all the money you want. I need the money, but I won't take it because I shall not sell my mother, on whom my life depends. She has no price. So I think these two people exemplify how to bring that belief that God created the world, that the environment is not ours. And it is a great challenge to bring into that public sphere that creation and creatures are sustained by God, that the environment is not just a natural capital, something that we put a price on, something that we can discount into the national accounting. It's a gift that we have received when we enter this world and that we leave when we die. So maybe this new partnership between DFID and faith communities could work on trying to find something to remind ourselves that our lives, our subsistence, doesn't depend on a computer, that our food doesn't just come from clicking on the online Tesco shopping, but that we need to recognize our environment, that our very existence is sustained by God. And the other theme I want to explore, where there could be some mutual understanding, is markets. DFID supports the private sector as the engine of economic growth, because businesses create jobs, they give income to the poor, they provide public services. And there is a lot of talk about financial inclusion, how to include the poor in markets. And of course, that's very important. But we should remind ourselves that markets are just simply means of exchanging goods to cover subsistence and to enable people to live well. And faith communities would support DFID engagement and support of markets in the private sector. But faith communities would warn that the inclusion of the poor in the markets is only a means to an end. And when that order is reversed, well, we face here what we call alienation. And I want to cite here the words of Jean Paul II, who is not really known to be very in great favor with Marxism. But in his encyclical Centesimus Annus, he urges the Christian community to recover the concept of alienation. He says, and I quote him, "The concept of alienation needs to be led back to the Christian vision of reality by recognizing in alienation a reversal of means and ends. A woman or a man is alienated if she refuses to transcend himself or herself and to live the experience of self-giving and of the formation of an authentic human community oriented towards his final destiny, which is God." And then he says, "A society is alienated if its forms of social organization, production and consumption make it more difficult to offer this gift of self and to establish solidarity between people." I think these words are very strong. You know, our society is alienated when markets become an end in themselves, when profits become an end in themselves, our societies become alienated. And one would probably link alienation with the global financial market, and there's been a lot of bashing of bankers the last 2 years. But the global is not separate from the local. And I would like just to tell the story of a market in the Philippines, in Manila. A friend of mine is currently working for VSO in the Philippines, and he tells me this story from a community in the north of Manila. He says, "Payatas, in the north of Manila, is home to one of the biggest rubbish mountains in the country. Many of the local people turn to scavenging, searching for any items that can be sold on. What might already sound like a difficult job became even tougher when the government sold on the rights to the rubbish mountain to a local colonel. He has since started charging local people for access, and he has struck up deals with the local scrap businesses so as to cut out the actual scavengers from the negotiating table. One local resident told me that this has led to a drop in wages, with scavengers now only earning about 60 pence per day. And he says, I find it hard to believe that someone can charge the poorest of the poor to scavenge through public waste. Such an advanced form of capitalism was previously unknown to me." I think the story is quite interesting. Now, we tend to bash the bankers of the global banks in London, but local markets can be alienated, and this case of a local market of recycling of a public rubbish dump in the Philippines can be as alienating for poor people as the global financial market. And faith communities have here a very crucial role to play, and far much beyond the usual provider of social services or partners with government with the MDGs, as we have often heard that faith communities are very efficient providers of services. Faith communities have a prophetic role in reordering markets to their proper end, to serve human beings and not to be the place where humans exploit others. Maybe this new partnership between DFID and faith communities could be about searching together for forms of production and market regulation so that markets are no longer alienating, but they can become means of exchange for human growth. And again, drawing back on the Catholic tradition, Catholic monastic communities have long produced goods and exchanged them in markets for the sake of fulfilling their needs. And probably when you were on holiday somewhere, you visited a monastery and bought some goods that they produced. And I think, for example, of a Cistercian monastery in Belgium, which produces Trappist beer, which is said to be one of the best in the world. But the monks only produce the amount of beer they need to meet the cost of running their monastery, and that's all. And one could argue, but why don't these monks produce more beer? Now, they could employ people, give jobs to the families in the region. They could turn the activity of beer making into a multi-million pound business, and then use the profits to help funding health and education in Africa or Asia. So why don't they do that? Why don't they invest more, produce more beer, and then distribute their profits to social services? Well, I'm not saying that global philanthropy is a bad thing, but it needs to be accompanied by a critical reflection on a form of social organization, production and consumption. One of the reasons for which the monks don't want to produce more is that they see the production of beer as part of their prayer life, and they don't want to engage into a global multi-business, multi-million pounds business, to that will detract them from what they see as their vocation. And I recently came across these words of Dorothy Day. Some of you will probably know her. She was the founder of the Catholic worker movement. And I think her words are very relevant for tonight. She says, "Love of brothers and sisters also means non-participation in those comforts and luxuries which have been manufactured by the exploitation of others. We must keep this vision in mind, recognize the truth of it, the necessity for it, even though we do not live up to it. We are ordered to be perfect, as our Heavenly Father is perfect, and we aim at it in our intention. Though in our execution we may fall short of the mark over and over. But as St. Paul says, it is by little and by little that we proceed." I think these words are very relevant for this new partnership between DFID and faith communities. We both share a common mission. And the DFID website emphasizes changing lives. DFID is about changing lives, about transformation, reducing poverty, making the world less unjust. It is our intention, but we fail at it a lot of times, both DFID and faith communities. Nonetheless, we can proceed little by little. And this discussion tonight is certainly a very good step forward for building a common vision between DFID and faith communities, and to try to translate this belief in God, this belief in this inseparability between the material and the spiritual, into the public sphere, into concrete policy. And I think that indigenous people are certainly showing the way forward by trying to bring the cosmovision into the public sphere. And I hope we can have a good discussion afterwards with different faith communities on how we can translate our belief in God into public policy. Thank you.